distortion in terms of the depth of that feeling.
James Harding, White House correspondent for the Financial Times newspaper, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
The Way to Paradise, the new novel by the Peruvian writer Mario Vargas Llosa, gives readers a dual narrative about the life and work of Paul Gauguin and his grandmother, the political organizer Flora Tristán. Alan Chews has a review.
As with any great writer, Vargas Llosa makes us see clearly what we've been looking at all the while but never noticed. In this case, the Peruvian connection to one of Europe's first utopian activists and one of the late 19th century's greatest artists, and their links to each other. First comes Flora Tristán, born in France out of wedlock to a Peruvian of high standing and a French mother. In cities all across mid-19th century France, she works to organize the lowest and most brutalized workers. Then comes Paul Gauguin, whose enormous life change in his early 30s led him from work as a stockbroker to an apprenticeship as a painter and elevation to the highest realms of artistic achievement. Like grandmother, like grandson, in alternating chapters, Vargas Llosa recounts their stories. For both of these people, two idealists struggling against the world, as Vargas Llosa presents them, paradise lies en otra esquina, in another corner, or elsewhere, as in the children's game both grandmother and grandson see played in the streets of France. And the book, to be honest, is not paradise for the average reader. It moves slowly, telling the story of each life in great detail, and making their differences stand out even as we notice their affinities. But in this, the master Peruvian novelist's first truly international novel, these lives light up with a passionate glow, even as the subjects struggle to flame on, then sputter out and die.
The book is The Way to Paradise by Mario Vargas Llosa. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. To find out about the music we play between stories, check the list of songs and artists at npr.org. Click the music button at the top of the page. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Citrix, providing access infrastructure for the on-demand enterprise for the Fortune Global 500 companies. Learn more at citrix.com. From Legato Systems, providers of enterprise-class open software solutions for information management. Learn more at legato.com. And from Procter & Gamble, makers of Metamucil, natural fiber for maintaining regularity, in powder, wafers, and capsules, Metamucil.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The 90-Second Naturalist.
Hi there, I'm Thane Maynard. Sometimes with all the discussion of the survival of the fittest, nature is painted as only one big competitive playing field. But there are many examples of animals, plants, and microbes of different species living closely together and cooperating in a relationship where they depend on each other for survival. This type of mutually helpful partnership is called symbiosis or mutualism. The advantage gained by each of the partners in the relationship can concern getting food, gaining protection or shelter, or improving the chances of breeding successfully. Termites, for instance, are social insects in the tropics that can digest cellulose in dead wood. They can do this only because in their gut, there's a collection of bacteria and single-celled animals called flagellates. It is actually these tiny partners that do the digesting. In return, they themselves get a shelter and a constant supply of food. But there are many other examples of this as well. Birds such as oxpeckers in Africa that live on the backs of rhinos or giraffes, eating the bugs off of them, getting a food source, but also keeping pests off the vertebrates.
The 90-Second Naturalist is a production of WGUC and is supported by the Angel Fund, the Cincinnati Zoo's program to save captive and wild cheetahs.
This is Public Radio from the Joseph S. Sample Studios at MSU Billings and from the John W. Fisher Studio at the Bozeman Public Library, KBMC, in Gillette, KYPR, and in Miles City, KECC.
And a good Friday evening to you, and welcome to Your Opinion, Please. Ken Siebert is back with us tonight after an evening of parental investment last night, since our friend Thane was just talking about evolutionary biology. That's an evolutionary biological term. Hard to get males to engage in parental investment. I imagine it's pretty easy with you, isn't it?
Yeah, well. I'm slogging my way through it, let's put it that way.
Anyway, Dan Eichlin is on the telephone tonight, and we welcome your calls at 657-2941 or 1-800-441-2941. We'd like to hear from you, and we have an eager beaver already here from
Billings.
Billings, you're on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening, Marvin. How are you?
Fine.
Good. I called last night, and you graciously said I only had 1 minute left,
yes.
And I felt I couldn't... express myself in that amount of time, so...
Now you have 34 minutes.
Well, I won't be that long.
Okay, all right.
But first of all, I consider myself a real conservative and a very true patriotic American as well. Actually, a former Republican who just can't espouse some of the recent activities of that party. One example... is this so-called energy bill. And the bill was stalled in the Senate today. We can go over that in a few minutes. But we need a real energy bill, a bill with real substance. For example, a bill that takes into account what are we willing to leave future generations, not just what are we willing to take now. One part of this energy bill that bothers me is the oil and gas drilling on the Rocky Mountain Front. The Rocky Mountain Front, to me, is, it's beyond special. It's an international treasure. First and foremost, the amount of reserves on the front, in comparison with our whole consumption, should be a very good reason in itself not to drill on the front. The reserves of gas would supply our whole gas needs for perhaps a few weeks. Our oil needs for maybe an hour or so. So that should be a good reason in itself not to ruin what's there. And I want to touch on something that the first caller stated last night. You had asked him the question about, well, don't the energy companies, don't they do a better job of drilling and leaving a smaller footprint? And yes, I'm sure they do. However, I mean, there are still tons of roads that apply to exploration and drilling and production. There are still compressor plants. There are still sweetening plants. And it's that whole industrialization that I would like to keep off the Rocky Mountain Front. Excuse me. I would consider other values over gas a much higher and better use of the front. For example, the front is in the top 1% of critical wildlife habitat, a Serengeti, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
The only place where grizzlies still utilize the plains habitat they once did. It might, could very well be one of the very few places where Lewis and Clark could actually still recognize the place. My family and I, our two young children, ages 6 and 12, we try to have at least one backpack trip per year into that Bob Marshall complex. Many of the trailheads we use are up and down the front country. And, to expound further on these trips, more often than not, these backpack trips are our family vacations. And we do include our young children, and they enjoy the area. It is those values and others as well which, for me, cement the idea of preservation of this special international treasure.
Well, the energy bill failed by 2 votes today. And Senator Domenici, I think it was, who said he's going to keep at it because he doesn't believe that all the Republicans who didn't cooperate, 6 of them, I believe, all of them really want to end up ultimately on the side they voted today. So he's going to keep after this. We had callers last night talk about trying to influence Senator Baucus on this issue. Do you know where Baucus stands right now?
Right at this moment, I can't say for certain. Hopefully, Senator Baucus has come around to more of a preservation of the front. That's hopefully. I don't know. There are actually rumblings from D.C., and rumblings is about all they are, that an energy bill won't be voted on yet this year. Mm-hmm. They're going to try, and I have no doubt that they are going to keep trying, but we need an energy bill that has some real teeth in it. I mean, something that has a real bite, something we can leave future generations. I mean, we need to include a lot of renewable resources, and you know, I'm a consumer of petroleum products as well as everyone else, but there are areas that are better suited and have greater proven reserves than our Rocky Mountain front, and it just pains me that why do we feel that we have to build a road or drill an oil or a gas well on every square mile or every acre for that matter, and it bothers me because it seems like we're in such a grab situation anymore that we don't seem to be thinking ahead for future generations.
Yeah, if it's good for anything, it's good for profit. Thank you very much. And we do have 3 callers waiting, so I'm going to move on. Thank you for calling.
You betcha. Thank you.
All right, and we have a caller on the line from
Helena.
Helena, good evening.
Good evening. Gee, what a coincidence. That's the same thing I had wanted to talk about. I want to express my extreme displeasure with Mr. Reberg, Burns, and Baucus. I got information this afternoon that Senator Baucus, I believe, voted to end discussion on this energy bill so that it could be voted on. And I would urge everybody that's interested to send him an email or a fax or make a phone call to his office. And if you hadn't read anything about this yet, there's an article in today's Billings Gazette. There's an article by Brad Molnar in the Outpost. There was an editorial a few days ago in the Denver Post about what a stinker this energy bill is. One of the things that's absolutely mind-boggling to me, they've got $2 billion in subsidies to the makers of the gasoline additive MTBE.
Mm-hmm.
To help them switch to a chemical that doesn't taint drinking water. We have that. It's called alcohol. We don't need to pay oil companies to invent some new chemical when we can use alcohol to do the same job. Plus, another part of this stinking bill and I think probably the part that helped kill it, is a provision that would exempt the manufacturers of this chemical additive from lawsuits for the pollution that it's caused. This thing is absolutely packed full of pork. It is not a good bill. It's never going to be a good bill. And the very way that it was crafted and created through this conference committee made up of only Republicans and dumped out on the Senate floor with really no chance for anybody to read an 1,100-page bill before it was supposed to be voted on.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely rot.
Thank you.
I may have expressed this opinion before, but I'm going to do it one more time. I believe there's no place where you can find a greater concentration of thieves and liars outside of a penitentiary than in the U.S. Congress.
Thank you for your call.
thank you.
Yes, that has been expressed before, not only by that gentleman, but by a few other people as well. And we have a caller from...
Helena.
Helena, good evening. Once again, Helena.
Hey, good evening. Well, folks are going to think, you know, why are these energy freaks hijacking the show? But the reason I'm calling is because it's a real big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's of utmost importance to Montana that this bill not pass, and it's not only the public land issues that your first caller talked about. I'm a member of Northern Plains Resource Council, and they're having their convention this year. I'm not able to make it. Their convention is going on right now.
Yes.
There's some rooms in a hotel in Billings full of some ranchers whose livelihoods are going to be adversely affected by pollution of their irrigation water and drawdown of their aquifers and drilling on their land if they have a split estate, and they have no control over it. And, you know, Burns is supposed to be a private property rights advocate, and, you know, Baucus, I'm sure, would consider himself one as well. And this is affecting their livelihoods, and there's nothing in this bill to protect them. So it's not only public lands issues. I'll confirm that Baucus did vote for cloture today, meaning vote to end debate on the bill,
mm-hmm.
which is effectively a vote to pass it,
yeah.
because they have enough votes to pass it. They need 60 to end debate. They only need a majority to pass.
Mm-hmm.
That is reprehensible, and we still have a chance to keep this from passing. I've heard that they may call for a vote on Sunday or Monday. As soon as they think they have the votes, they're going to call for one again.
Sure.
If we can turn Baucus, they've got to get one more vote. And I think that Max Baucus, if he responds to anything, it's to fear. If he stands for anything, it is that he wants to be a U.S. senator. And I think if he sees, you know, if he gets 1,000 calls a day, it may turn him. So I'm going to give the number again.
And the minority leader, too, Senator Daschle from South Dakota, is up for re-election next year, and I'm sure that influenced his vote to end debate and to support the bill.
Yeah, they say he's getting some ethanol plants out of this deal.
Yeah,
which you can get if you're minority leader.
Right. Okay, you had a number for Baucus?
Yeah, I'd love to give that.
Okay.
That is 800-332-6106. And I think you can leave a message after hours there. If not, call Monday morning, because we never know. It could even be too late by then. This is important for Montana.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks again for your time.
All right. Yes, and we go until 5 after 7 tonight, so we have quite a bit of time remaining. 657-2941 is our number in the Billings calling area. Anywhere else you may be listening, in Wyoming or Montana, call us at 1-800-441-2941, and we have a caller from...
Billings.
Billings, good evening.
Hey, guys, how are you?
All right.
I wanted to take issue with your second-to-last caller last night. I'm going to change the subject.
Okay.
Seems as if he had a little misplaced anger directed at you guys when probably the most demonstrably dishonest administration in the history of our country is getting a free pass on a daily basis from the mainstream media, and he's mad at a couple of guys on public radio. Seems a little crazy to me.
Well, in fairness, I would put the Johnson administration right up next to it, but go ahead.
The Gulf of Tonkin.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, I just kind of wanted to conclude by saying there are two reasons that you would vote Republican in 04, and they are that you're either morally bankrupt or you're woefully uninformed. Thank you.
Okay. Short and to the point there.
We have a caller from Billings.
Billings, good evening.
Hi there. I'll be real brief. I just wanted to comment on the incredible stagnation of environmental politics in the United States. I think that callers like your first two today, I think if they're going to want to affect real change, they're going to have to be proactive as opposed to reactive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've seen a lot of that.
Okay, now tell us what that means.
Go ahead.
Well, just tell us what proactive means in that context, if you could.
Proactive means having a plan, having some alternatives to what the Republican Party is doing.
Okay.
Having some type of plan to be able to point to and say, this would be better.
Okay.
As opposed to the continuous knee-jerk reaction, because I think they're losing the public.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I also would like to inform people to come to Rocky Mountain College's Insect Play Friday at 8 o'clock and Saturday at 8 o'clock at BST.
Okay, you mean by tonight and tomorrow night?
Tonight and tomorrow night.
Okay, at 8 o'clock at BST.
The last opportunity.
The Insect Play, okay. Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, that that has received a lot of interesting comment. And we have a caller from...
Helena.
Helena, once again. It's a Helena night. Go ahead.
Good evening. Glad to be with you. Yeah, I wanted to ditto those other people. I'm not actually certain that everybody can be convicted of moral bankruptcy if you're voting Republican, but, you know, there's other issues there.
Yeah.
I wanted to pick up where the fellow last night was calling you, and he was a conservative and talking to you about, well, you've got this liberal point of view and it's really not fair. I think what he was saying was it's, you know, not fair that you would have liberal commentators or liberal talk show hosts hosting a program. And you know, you remember the person, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the response that I think that the man was making a point, and I think that you attempted to defend it on the basis of, well, we're actually neutral. Well, I don't buy that.
Okay.
I'm more on your side than I am on his.
Well, none of us is neutral. I'll acknowledge that. Yeah.
Yeah, and there is a bias to the way you handle things, but I think that's okay. But more importantly, you folks, you know, instead of defending yourself about, you know, objectivity or something on the basis of objectivity or something like that, you folks attempt to create the basis for dialogue,
mm-hmm.
even though you may have a point of view. And yeah, Ken may be kind of loose-lipped with some of his liberal comments or comments about George Bush, whichever you know, if you want to construe them that way.
But in the Iraq War, loose lips did not sink ships.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You're drawing me off.
Okay, go ahead.
You folks are, it seems to me, your strength is trying to draw people into dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And as opposed to a lot of conservative commentators whose only interest is in diatribe and propaganda and pushing their view, and I think that you do make an obvious attempt to treat people with respect, to try and draw people out, to try and talk about the issues, and to hear more points of view than does happen on most conservative so-called talk shows, which
yeah.
are more about entertainment, I think, than public policy many times.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunately...
Well, they have to do that. I'm sure you understand why. Because if they don't have high ratings, they're not on the air.
Yeah.
We're not quite in that same boat. But if Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly don't have a sufficient number of listeners to sell products, they're simply off the air, period.
Right. Well, they lost me as a listener. The only conservative talk show host I think is worth diddly is actually Gordon Liddy, who you can sometimes have a conversation with.
Yeah.
And I have heard him treat people with respect and hear them out. But I think that some of his views on, you know, sex and rock and roll just outraged some of his base listener groups. So he has been losing listenership steadily. Because that base, that core group isn't with him. They want to hear what they want to hear.
I mean, he used to, in the old days, hold his hand over a burning candle. You can do that on the radio easier than you can on TV.
Yeah, well, I think some of his macho aspects are a little bit weird, but, you know.
Ken and I can do that right here.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I think I've made the
Thank
point
you. Yes.
that you don't need to be as defensive as I thought I heard you being,
yeah.
or
well, you know,
hear those people's point, but go with your strength.
You know, it's interesting though that if you ever watch Buchanan and Press on MSNBC, do you ever watch them?
No, I don't think so.
They're two opposite ends of the spectrum, and they're co-hosts, and they do modify each other. Both of them are less extreme on that program together than they are when they're alone, and I think that's kind of interesting. They're more deferential to each other. Anyway, appreciate your call.
Good evening.
All right. And we have a caller on the line from
Bozeman.
Bozeman, good evening.
Hi. I wanted to agree with some of your previous callers about how terrible this energy bill is. And the question that I have, I guess I stand back and sort of just confounded at why we don't even consider trying to see if conservation can't save us energy and make us more energy independent and all the goals that this energy bill is supposed to provide. It seems to me that in California last summer, I think when they were having the blackouts, that they were able to conserve something like 20% of their energy just voluntarily in a really short amount of time, you know, when the crisis hits. And here we have, you know, we've got a vice president who says conservation may be a virtue, but it's not an energy policy. And I just,
no.
I just think, I mean, for me, it's a pride in being American is that there's ingenuity and there's the ability to pull it together. And like during, I wasn't alive during World War II, but people, you know, all saved.
Sure.
And it made an enormous difference.
And President Bush even mentioned the hydrogen automobile in his last State of the Union address, and they're out there being tested on the road right now. I mean, it seems like you could have a realistic emphasis on that kind of saving of petroleum.
Well, sure. I mean, that's a new fuel source.
That's right.
And I'm supportive of developing new sources of renewable energy.
But I mean,
what this energy bill does is provide enormous subsidies for corporations for rampant extraction of our natural resources, which is really radical, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're conservative, I think focusing on conservation is just something you would naturally seek out rather than, you know, because once we tear up the landscape and pollute the waterways, I mean, there's no turning back. And I just feel like we haven't exhausted the possibilities of seeing. Just try. Why don't we just see if we can try conserving and see what happens?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. And we have lots of calls tonight, so we're going to get right on to the next one.
Mm-hmm. From Boulder.
Boulder, good evening.
Well, good evening. I just wanted to say that I think that Ken's a little bit liberal and you're a little bit right in the middle. And I kind of like the, you know, but I wish there was a little more right-wingers there, too.
Well, Ken is younger, and younger people tend to be a little more radical. Older people tend to be a little more conservative. Isn't that the way it goes?
So you're blaming this all on the insouciance of youth? Is
Oh, yes.
Well, I don't know. I was a teenager. I was a teenager during the radical 60s, and I saw them as a bunch of wild animals.
So, okay, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say that.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
All right. So I'm more of a middle-of-the-road kind of guy. Now, some people would say that means I'm wishy-washy.
Mm.
But, you know, I would say that my instincts have been tempered a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've said to friends who've quizzed me about it that I am a libertarian in the morning and a socialist in the afternoon. And I do have instincts, strong instincts in both directions. But I think that age has tempered both of those instincts a bit,
mm-hmm.
simply because of what I've experienced and read and watched happen in government and so forth. And when you get to be my age, Ken.
Uh-huh.
We have a caller on the line from
Dogwater.
Dogwater, good evening.
Good evening.
Ah, yes.
just wanted to comment on the perceived bias on this program. There's nothing wrong with bias. I mean, that's what life is about. History itself is ideas and is full of bias.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that there has to be some sort of balance because public radio is just that, public radio, is really, you know, pretty absurd. It might be interesting to have someone with a, you know, right-wing conservative bent, but I was just thinking, you know, where are you going to find this person who's going to be able to use words like insouciant, though? And I'm just not really sure where that's going to happen. Last week, or a couple weeks ago, I read the two McCarthy chapters in Ann Coulter's latest book, expecting to be thoroughly angered.
Yeah.
And actually, it was almost funny.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't really even disappointed. I mean, the only emotion I could possibly muster would be to feel sad that there's people that, you know, are desperate to believe this sort of thing. And I think that's the main thing. They don't understand that even her books are entertainment. They're not history or even full of facts.
It's sad, regardless of what perspective you're coming from, it's sad to suggest that people in the past all should have known better. They all should have known then what we know now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not a fair way to approach history from any direction.
Oh, no, you can't. But, of course, that you know, turn that on its head, then a lot of people will say, we'll defend the practice of slavery, you know, vis-a-vis our founding fathers, that, you know, that they didn't really know anybody. Well, they did know better.
Yeah.
You know, a lot
sure.
of people knew better.
Yep.
And, you know, that's...
But they sometimes knew things intellectually better that they didn't know economically. In other words, they didn't know how to get out of an economic system that they were a part of easily, although they instinctually wanted to do that. And I think that you find that in Jefferson especially, that there is no great defense in Jefferson's writing for the institution of slavery, and yet it was a very important part of his own economic life. No
well,
question
certainly.
About it. No, no
certainly.
Question
but
about
he's
it.
Also the man who came up with the 3/5 of a person.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, thanks a lot.
Thanks you for your call. I appreciate that. And you know, whoever mentioned ideas, I mean, it, what is different about public radio, I think, and not in all instances, but in many instances, is the importance of ideas. I don't care whether somebody's coming from the right, or middle, or from the left, if they really are self-critical.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the ideas they entertain and are willing to consider the ideas that other people are putting forward, rather than simply looking, as somebody emailed me today, that people on the left and the right both tend to judge people by their label rather than what they're actually saying. They're not really listening to what people are actually saying. They're trying to label them. And once you can label somebody, that you can dismiss them then, or you can embrace them as one of your own.
Well, the last, you know. I think the last 5 years have been incredibly hard on discourse in America. I think with the rise of cable news and the idea of this adversarial punditry that we have, that, you know, where it's almost like the host ends up being a referee, where they just let them go at each other's throats, and that's being taken for what public discourse really is.
Right.
And it's unfortunate that sitting down for an hour and a half to 3 hour symposium doesn't really make it. It's not sexy enough to end up on the on cable network news. So what we get is this just horrid arguing, and that's
That's why we carry Warren Olney's program, is because it is a program that holds people's feet to the fire in terms of what they say, and also compares them directly with people who hold opposite ideological views. And then I've said on this program before, and then I'll shut up and we'll move on to the next listener's call. On Sunday morning, Tim Russert has a really decent public affairs program in which he asks intelligent questions and lets people give their answers. And if they don't give intelligent answers, he's after them. And that's the way it should be. No yelling, no screaming, no name calling. But it's an honest, intellectual pursuit of answers to questions. The other program, and this is going to probably, surprise some people, is on the Fox News Network on Sunday morning. And that is where Bill Kristol from the Weekly Standard, Juan Williams from NPR, Mara Liasson from NPR sit down with Tony Snow and Britt Hume from the Fox Network, and they have a civilized discussion of issues. Again, where they're not yelling at each other or talking over each other, but actually they have an honest disagreement about issues, and I find it very edifying. So even if it is on Fox, which generally I'm not terribly pleased with, it's a good program, and one should watch it. It's on at 8 or 8:30 on Sunday mornings. Fox News Weekend, I think it's called. Now, the next caller is from
Buffalo, Wyoming.
Buffalo, Wyoming. Good evening.
Good evening. Yes. even that isn't worth $30 a month, though.
No? Okay.
However, what I wanted to remind people was that we had an experience in the Vietnam War in which soldiers were directed to go into Vils and burn hooches and blow up the Vils, and we ended up with B-52s doing the same thing. And now here in Iraq, we have soldiers being directed to go into people's houses, kick them out, blow the houses up, and we're now down to dropping 1,000-pound bombs in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's absolutely reprehensible in the first place that we should attack civilians. In the second place, it's a losing tactic. It lost us in Vietnam. It will lose us in Iraq if we keep up with this kind of insanity. Something must be done in the line of infiltration or whatever into these populations or lash-ups of people or gangs or whatever into the society. You know, something that wasn't planned ahead of time, mm-hmm. of course, but something needs to be done to get the information about where these guys are coming from, and sure information, not maybe mm-hmm. information, not, you know, some warehouse that was used a couple of weeks ago or any of that kind yeah. of stuff. Real hard facts, and then go after them with less objectionable means. I mean, there are lots of means that are far more effective and less objectionable than a one-ton bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Just, it's ridiculous.
We have four callers. Got to move on. Thank you
okay.
very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Your call. And a one-minute piece now again.
Yeah.
Here we are, down to 1 minute per caller. You're from
Billings.
Billings, good evening.
Less than a minute. In regards to the comment about people in the past and knowing better about slavery, I would ask the gentleman what he would do about the 1,000 people that are homeless here in Billings tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Secondarily, in regards to the comment about Ms. Coulter's book, you need to remember that the right-wing self-proclaimed is usually the sophomoric, led by the tendentious, committed to the moronic. And
lots of syllables there. Thank you.
I will leave it at that.
Right, thank you much. He always uses so many syllables. I mean, I have to go home and look these words up, you know.
Well, that's okay. That's what the dictionary's for.
We have a caller from
Lewistown.
1 minute. Go ahead.
Hi, I just want to take issue with this opinion that has been expressed a number of times that it is only the you know, left-wing liberal and Democrats in the nation who are intelligent. I mean,
yeah.
This is such an absurd and self-aggrandizing kind of notion. You know, and I consider myself a liberal, but I
yeah,
mean,
sure.
How about William Safire,
yes.
George Will?
That's right.
William F. Buckley Jr. is probably mm-hmm. the greatest rhetorician around. It's the spin that gets put on this. I don't know. It's sort of a smugness that makes me real disappointed in liberals.
You're absolutely
to tell you
right.
the truth.
You're absolutely right. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bye.
No, there are other people that we. Well, I mentioned William Crystal,
mm-hmm.
Crystal before, and he's a good, thoughtful person. Probably the best one is David Brooks, who is a conservative thinker, but who is an extremely intelligent writer, now works for the New York Times. We have a caller on the line from
Billings.
Billings, 1 minute, please.
Good evening, real quick. Yesterday, Wall Street Journal, op-ed page, a column by Al Hunt, where was Max? He just fried Max Baucus. He said a fraudulent Medicare bill was a testament to the skills and resourcefulness of Republican congressional leaders and to the lack of skills and backbone of a top Democrat, Max Baucus.
Very interesting.
And then he goes on to fry him as the senior Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, mm-hmm. and he starts going in, calling him a case study in legislative weakness.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating thing. Baucus is really getting heat right now for the AARP.
Yes. It was a grassroots rebellion.
People are burning their AARP cards.
You said this was Al Hunt, and where did you hear it or read it?
No, it's in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. Oh,
okay, Wall Street. All right, thank you very much.
Yes,
yeah.
Bye.
Yesterday's Wall Street Journal. And we have one last call.
No, we don't.
We don't. Hey, time is just perfect here. We're ending on time. And I'm sure Dan will appreciate that because we often sort of leave him with time to make up. And
mm-hmm.
he hasn't the opportunity to do that. Dan Eichlin on the telephone tonight. Ken Siebert ably in control. And we'll be back next week. Thank you.
Your Opinion, Please is supported in loving memory of Grant Tyler by his parents, Sandy and David. KEMC from the Joseph S. Sample Studios at Montana State University, Billings, and KBMC from the John W. Fisher Studio at the Bozeman Public Library, KYPR Gillette, and KECC Miles City.
Living on Earth is supported by Joel and Ann Guthels in recognition of Billings Cooperative Grocery, the Good Earth Market, winner of the 2003 Montana Aero Sustainable Agriculture Award. The Good Earth Market is open to everyone 7 days a week on 10th Avenue North, featuring organic and locally grown food, a full-service deli, and earth-friendly products.
Support for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation and Stonyfield Farm.
Welcome to Living on Earth. I'm Bruce Gellerman, sitting in for Steve Curwood. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency will soon release a proposal to cut emissions of mercury from power plants. Mercury is a powerful neurotoxin that can harm the human nervous system. It's especially dangerous to the developing brain of a fetus. 45 states now have advisories warning against eating some types of fish contaminated with mercury. But as Jeff Young reports from Washington, environmental groups and some members of Congress worry that the new federal mercury limits will be too little, too late.
The federal government cracked down on mercury pollution from medical waste and city trash incinerators in the 1990s, but ignored one notable source, coal-fired power plants. Conservation groups like the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington thought that was an odd omission. NRDC's John Walk says those power plants are the country's biggest source of mercury, pumping out 48 tons a year.
Coal-fired power plants got a special deal in the 1990 Clean Air Act, and then subsequently EPA dragged its feet until finally a lawsuit by my organization, NRDC, forced EPA to study mercury from power plants and to admit that the problem was enormous and demanded cleanup under this program by 2004.
Walk's group won a court settlement forcing the EPA to issue standards for mercury emissions control. Walk says these so-called MACT, Maximum Available Control Technology standards, usually result in dramatic cuts by giving polluters a deadline to find and use pollution reduction technology. He thinks a mercury MACT should call for cuts of 90% or more, but that's not what he expects the EPA to call for next month.
I expect EPA to issue a rule proposal that will contain a range of options, and there are some already disturbing signs that the Bush administration is contemplating a rule that would reduce less than 50% of mercury from the coal-fired power sector.
Walk says the lower target would violate the Clean Air Act, but that law is viewed quite differently just a few blocks away on Washington's K Street. That's where Scott Siegel directs the Electric Reliability Coordinating Council from his office in the lobbying firm Bracewell & Patterson. Siegel says the Clean Air Act gives EPA flexibility on mercury cuts. He thinks the agency should only set limits power plants can meet with technology that's already in place.
They ought to be set in their first phase, at least, at the levels that we're likely to achieve from reductions already.